Hi, this is a lecture on the Althusser text, ideology and ideological state apparatuses. And then I also gave you just 2 pages from the very beginning of Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman's Manufacturing Consent, which is kind of a classic book on propaganda as it exists within the capitalist United States. So in general, this week, if you didn't get the announcement, I have thinned our reading down for the week. So the Guy Debord that we were originally going to read this week, which does definitely fit together with what we're looking at today, that's going to be pushed to next week. And we'll do it together with Dorfman and Mädelhart's text from Chile in the early 1970s about Disney and its colonial representations of the so-called third world. Anyway, that's all next week. So this week we have only this text on ideology and a little bit of Chomsky's text about propaganda. The second thing, just by way of introduction, it would probably be a good idea if you're listening to this lecture also to pull up the notes that I posted. They include a few diagrams, which I hope you can read. And if you look at those, I think it'll make what I'm talking about here a lot easier to follow. There's basically, I guess, there's 4 diagrams. The first one is an overall diagram of the Marxist model of ideology as Althusser presents it. I think he gives the best presentation I know of. The second one distinguishes between state apparatuses and ideological state apparatuses. The one that I'll go to third is a diagram of how to think about propaganda. Think about media production, but realize that media production is an industrial process, that it requires raw materials. And that in the production of media products, according to Chomsky, a selection process takes place by which it's relatively guaranteed that the items that are mass distributed by means of our current media system are the items that are approved by our corporate masters. And then the last one, the last diagram, tries to show how ideologies within different ISAs, ideological state apparatuses, how they are, the way that Althusser puts it, subsumed under a ruling ideology. How are they unified? Churches and schools and the insides of police departments and the insides of trade unions are relatively different places with different codes of conduct and different dominant ideologies. Nevertheless, the claim is, and I think this is probably correct, that in some fashion, each one of these, what I think we would call regional ideologies, is calibrated, is integrated into an overarching so-called ruling ideology, which includes things like national ideology. Okay, so that's it. There are these 4 diagrams, and what I'm going to say is basically just going to step you through these things. Now, how is this text related to our course? Well, to me, it's absolutely central because I have taught this course attempting to think about success and American values in general as varieties of ideology. And to me, this is the clearest and strongest presentation of an updated version of Marx's theory of ideology that I know of. So from the beginning, I had this sort of stuff in mind. Now, the beginning of the course, we talked about content primarily. What are the dominant American values? What are the ones that we've heard the most about? What are the contradictions between them? What are the contradictions between those alleged values and our actual practices, and so on. Now, in this portion of the course, we're more interested in the distribution of those so-called values. So that is that is what we're looking at today. We get a model about how should we understand dominant ideas, but then more importantly, where are dominant ideas made dominant? How do they become, and how do they continue to be the primary ideas by which, in this case, we as Americans tend to identify ourselves? How does that come about? So first we're going to get a look at varieties of ideology and the hypothetical relationship between ideology and practices as that is laid out in Marxist theory. What we're really looking for there is a realization that the dominant values in a society have got to have some kind of ongoing and functional relationship with the dominant practices in a society. If they were systematically at odds with one another, each would interfere with the other, and, production and the so-called smooth and orderly functioning of our society would at least slow, if not coming to a halt. There's got to be some kind of pre-established harmony between these things. And so we want to talk about, what is that harmony? What types of ideology are there, etc.? This is question number one. What's ideology on the Marxist view? Question number two, though, goes straight to this portion of the course, because it asks, let me back up. Diagram number two, which distinguishes between state apparatus and ideological state apparatuses, first of all, attempts to answer the question, how does the control in our society of vast numbers of workers by a very small number of actual owners, how is such a situation maintained? And what Althusser is basically doing is he's taking Marx and he's saying, Marx may have been right about the state apparatus, but his answer about how control was maintained was incomplete. In addition to the state apparatus, there must be ideological state apparatuses, which are things like churches, schools, family, etc. We'll go through that in detail. And in doing this, he's basically just ripping off he's formalizing, I suppose, and working through a theory that was offered by the Italian Marxist theorist Antonio Gramsci. So Althusser is putting together, Althusser is generating ideology, although he would like to say that it's not ideology, which is a place where I tend to disagree with him. He thinks it's science. He's taking Marx and then he's taking Gramsci and he's reconstructing them in 1968, which is a pretty significant year, and he's putting them together into new construction. And basically what he wants to say is that in order for a ruling class to rule, it must certainly control the state apparatus, but that is insufficient. If it is to rule for a long period of time, it must also control at least a majority of ideological state apparatuses. So there's got to be a domination, at least in terms of ideas, within the churches, which is the sort of thing that we looked at in Cruz, for example. Immediately post-World War II, the National Association of Manufacturers, but also other corporate entities, figured out how to get their message, how to get their ideology into the churches. They systematically, and on a very large scale, organized clergy so as to have those clergy indoctrinate their passive, receptive church populations. Now, that's an ideological state apparatus, in such a fashion that the thought and understanding and consequently the action of those religious people would match up with the interests of the owners. That's the sort of thing we're looking at today, but we're looking at it on a very broad scale. So that's the overview. How does control get maintained? And, very technically speaking, how is it that a productive apparatus. So, I mean, think about this. On a Marxist model, if we want to understand our present circumstance, we need to do that by looking at the way in which we manufacture the things that allow us to live, the way that we manufacture in general. And if you think, this is in Marx the term that we're talking about here, if we're looking at the broad existence of an interconnected system of production, where certain industries provide raw materials for other industries, where certain industries ship the products of other industries, etc. If you think about the whole industrial, infrastructural, and then labor landscape that characterizes us today, for one thing, you'll have to recognize that that is radically different from the infrastructure and labor and division of labor, the kinds of different jobs that existed, say like 100 years ago or 50 years ago. This, in Marx, the name of this phenomenon is the mode of production. Well, the mode of production changes across time. So, you know, 50 years ago, when my parents were young and they were just entering the workforce, there was no, you know, web design, of course. There was no back-end database programming jobs like my friend next door to where I live has. The division of labor, the type of jobs, the type of production that is happening changes all the time. So how does society, and of course the structure of the society, in great measure will have to correspond to the division of labor offered by the mode of production. So the social structure follows changes in the manufacturing and technical structure. This is basic Marxist theory. The question that Althusser asks is, well, how do you keep producing workers who are going to fit into this ever-changing mode of production, this ever-changing productive infrastructure, this ever-changing division of labor? And his answer is that the ISAs take care of that, ideological state apparatuses, especially including schools. And he really focuses primarily on schools. They do that work. Okay, I think that's it for my overview. Now let's go back to the beginning. We want to ask about ideology. We've been studying ideology all the way through this class, but today we get a formal definition and careful analysis of types of ideology and of the relationship between ideology and practices. Now, this is a Marxist model, and Althusser is taking that model and he is formalizing it, clarifying it. Okay, so if you want to listen to Marx, and you have a question for him. Say you have the question, which I think is a good question to ask. How do I understand the world that I am in a non-subjective way? What can I really know about the world that I'm in, as opposed to just hitting, you know, being barraged by one after another, often contradictory, piece of information and media? How can I really know where I am? The Marxist answer is, start by looking at your activity. Start by looking at your job. Think about where you work. And if you start to look at where you work, you'll see, first of all, class relationships, relations of control. You should also see many of the things that we've been looking at up until this point in the class, especially with C.L.R. James. Namely that, okay, a good portion of your life, though you are nominally a free and independent American, whenever you're at work, you're not very free because you're told what to do and you had better do it or else you're going to lose your job, right? And this doesn't entirely change as labor becomes more and more precarious. So here I am sitting in my little hut that I built in my backyard with all my music equipment around me, which is, you know, the other thing that I do in this room, and I'm recording into a little handheld recorder that I got just like sitting on my chest. I'm not at work, But I had better do the work associated with my job, or I will very quickly lose that job. And that's super easy for me as an adjunct, by the way. Okay, so you'll see many things if you look at where you work. And you can also start to see that everywhere that people work is connected to other places where people work. So the easiest way to think about this is to imagine manufacturing. Like, let's take a... Okay, you say you work at a factory that makes pens. Although, of course, we also know that manufacturing jobs are increasingly outsourced. But it's an easy way to look at things, and it's true for just about anything, any type of job, that it is dependent upon other jobs. At a pen factory, they don't make plastic. They import plastic, or they ship in, they purchase plastic as a raw material from the petroleum industry, right? They don't necessarily manufacture ink. They might well buy that from another plant. They certainly do not manufacture stainless steel or aluminum. They buy those things from other industries. Now, if you shift over to the aluminum industry, where do they manufacture everything that they use? Certainly not. They have to buy metals or alloyed metals from other places. They have to receive things from the extractive industry. So the reason that I'm going through this potentially endless list of examples is just to show you that the manufacturing infrastructure, which is what Marx thinks is the realest part of our lives, you know, the infrastructure physically, but then our participation within it, it is globally integrated at this point. Okay, and if you want to know the most important thing from a Marxist point of view about that infrastructure, it is that it is controlled by a very specific class of individuals. Now, we're not interested in communist revolution in particular in this class, although in my other class, Age of Revolt, we do talk about that stuff a lot. The Marxist goal for history would be to have the so-called means of production. That means anything and everything that is involved in your work. The means of production ought to be controlled by the workers. By the way, that is something that I believe, although I don't personally, I don't dig the Marxist idea of radical centralization of all these things, because I think effectively that's just another way of taking control of workplaces away from workers. But the reason that this can be, a large-scale historical goal is that it's not the reality now. What is the reality now? Well, the reality is that corporations and a small group of wealthy individuals own all the places where all of us work. They own the means of production. And they want to continue owning the means of production, because owning the means of production puts them in a position to harvest the profit from production. On the Marxist model, what's profit? Profit is the difference between the amount of value that workers produce by being in the office or in the factory or here on my hill all day long. It's the difference between the amount of value they actually produce and how much they are paid. Workers are always paid less than what they generate. And you can this is not a conspiracy theory. You know, if a business came out flat, just came out even month after month after month, because whatever they got, they distributed equally to their employees, it wouldn't be a capitalist business anymore, and it would go out of business, right? Okay. So the owners need to stay in control. But this produces a problem. Now, workers who start to think through what's going on in their world might start thinking, oh, this isn't fair. We generate the profit, but they take it. Wait, shouldn't we oppose ourselves to ownership? This is a rational thing to do. I personally have trouble seeing in any way how the interests of owners and the interests of workers can ever be the same, given that the owners want to get the maximum profit out of the workers, and the workers would like to get the maximum amount of benefits and pay out of the owners. They have opposed agendas. Ideology steps in order to solve this problem on behalf of owners. And you could even make this broader. Ideology steps in order to solve this problem on behalf of whoever is in control of the means of production. Because clearly there was ideology and propaganda in the Soviet Union too. You don't only have to have capitalism in order to have ideology. It's just that we happen to have that in our circumstance. So it is corporations, in large measure, who own the means of production, who control our lives, who, at least while we're at work, but then we become consumers. So they're marketing to us, and they're playing on our fears, and they're giving us, you know, lures to choreograph our behavior and all this. So they're controlling us in a whole lot of ways. But they would like it to be the case that we did not think of it in this way. Because if we think, it's good to be friends with corporations, if we think that way, we will be better employees from their perspective. We will be calm and we will be subdued, etc. Ultimately, this is what Althusser will say, is that the work of ideological state apparatuses, which we'll define shortly, is to produce skilled labor and to produce submissive labor. And in certain cases, to train a managerial class to utilize ideology so as to guarantee submissive and productive labor. Okay, so now let's look at diagram number one here. In Marxist terms, we can talk about two different orders of reality. Now, of course, they're both real, but one, the claim is more real than the other, or at the very least, one is in a determinative relationship to the other. It determines what's going to happen with the other. So the more important of these two dimensions is the so-called base. And that's what I've been talking about. The material practices arranged physically in conjunction with technology and architecture. So infrastructure and labor having a particular form and character, etc. The technology, the infrastructure, etc. in Marxist theory are called forces of production, sometimes means of production. And then the way in which labor is organized, so that certain people have to take orders from others. Certain people are in charge of taking care of the books, while others are in charge of thinking through supply lines. This is called the division of labor, and broadly speaking, in Marxist theory, this is called relations of production, which includes class relations. If we were to go to the biggest scale, those who own the means of production, those who own Amazon warehouses, etc., they constitute one class, and they live in a way different way than you and I do. And then there's the rest of us who work for them, and we have harder lives and smaller lives and less glamorous lives and less luxurious lives. So classes are produced out of the real objective organization of individuals with respect to the system of production. This is basic Marxist theory. Now, there's a second dimension of things which are either less real, and I think in a lot of ways Marx and Althusser both think this. You know, ideology has to do with illusions in a lot of ways, and ideas in a certain way do seem to be less real than, say, objects and chairs and actions. But what's more important is that this so-called superstructure, meaning something which is built upon the base, is ultimately determined by the base. That is, the class relationships, especially the class relationships that are a part of or correspond to the way in which production takes place, those also bear upon what are going to become the dominant ideas. Okay, so let's look just at the superstructure portion here. On Althusser's reading, and I think he's reading this right because I've read this Marx stuff a lot too, he says there are two tiers to the superstructure. There are two varieties or two dimensions of ideology. One, which seems to be less ethereal than the other, is the whole world of politics and legislation. Now, the point here is to say politics and legislation, you know, some people think that power rests in politics. The Marxist view, which is also my view in this case, I'm not systematically Marxist. There's plenty of Marxist stuff I don't agree with, but Marx's analysis of capitalism, I think, is pretty solid. There are other views which suggest that power rests in politics, but the Marxist view is like, no. Power rests in ownership and control over labor and behavior on a day-by-day basis and control over the accumulation and harvesting of profit. So how then should we understand politics? Politics is like a puppet show. You see the protagonist and you see the antagonist and they're dueling together, but any grown-up person knows that that puppet has a hand up its puppet. Somebody's controlling the actions of those entities, and they're producing a show that looks autonomous, but in fact it's not autonomous. How do we translate this? What happens in politics is determined by ownership in the background. And if you have real conflict in politics, it's only because there's real conflict between different manufacturers, different owners. But that conflict that can well exist between, say, like the tech industry and the oil industry. You know, I often think like the Bush regime was an oil presidency. The Obama regime was closer to a tech regime. It's kind of hard to tell, like, which manufacturing sector is Trump associated with, but we could guess, real estate, like, where does he come from? Real estate and certain varieties of construction, infrastructure building. But the conflicts between sectors of the owning class are always going to be limited. They are never going to disagree about whether there ought to be an owning class or not. They are never going to disagree about whether they ought to be the owning class. They are never going to disagree about whether workers should shut up and work for lower wages. They're all agreed on all that stuff. They know what benefits them. They have a shared common interest. So what's happening in politics is a sort of distraction away from the basic relationships of domination within a society. Same thing for legislation. You know, Marx would say that, you know, capitalism, it can operate in many different circumstances. Capitalism operated still in Nazi Germany, and I tend to buy the thesis that fascism is a form of social organization that capitalism retreats to in times of crisis. And if the U.S. has fascist tendencies, particularly under Trump, it could be, in my opinion, understood in that way. But capitalism does seem to prefer parliamentary democracy. Why? Because when legislation, which if we are to be good Marxists here, legislation which really ultimately comes from and benefits the owning class, when that legislation is passed from a bill, you know, and we know in our case, beginning with organizations like ALEC, right, which is a consortium of corporations devoted to the generation of bills, of potential legislation, there's a private sector which makes suggestions about the laws and hands them, in many cases, to Congress people. Congress people introduce it into Congress, it passes over to the Senate, eventually it can be run by the president, and it gets made into a law, right? This process is really desirable because it produces the illusion that whatever laws have been agreed upon, because they have been discussed and voted upon by the people who we allegedly elected, and I say allegedly because majority of Americans don't vote, and also because the people who get on the ballot and the people who ultimately win has a lot more to do with how much money they got than it has to do with like free decision making on our part, right? And realize that there is something really nasty going on here, where the techniques of the production of public opinion, which we've been studying with respect to advertising, those exact same firms, public relations firms, marketing firms, those exact same experts and those exact same techniques are employed in generating political opinions. This is one of the major reasons that more money typically means greater chances of election. Why? Because more money means more generation of ideological material, more generation of programming, more generation of image distribution and high quality image distribution, which act in a fairly dependable way upon the so-called decision making of this populace, this blob populace, administered populace, which we are all a part of. So they have nominally been elected, and they nominally represent us. And because they sign off on this legislation, we can nominally believe, and people can feel very deeply, provided that they have not actually reflected on the matter, that the laws that by this means pass into being are the ones that we have all agreed upon. Capitalism likes, corporations like, owners like, the illusion of democracy. They like representative democracy with, you know, maximally corrupt elements. So the Marxist view on this whole thing is politics, legislation, are determined in the background by the economic system, and particularly by economic ownership. What happens in the political form is a variety of ideology, and what that means is that it is something to be understood and thought about, so it's ideational, but it's also something which is determined in the background, which is framed or limited, and sometimes directly set up by a certain small portion of the society. The owners, the big owners, the ones, if look back to last week, ultimately by some group like the power elite. Not that they weigh in on every little thing, but they weigh in where it's necessary. They keep things within bounds. Now, there's another tier to this structure, and this is the stuff that Marx really thinks is least real in the world, even though plenty of people, especially conservative people and like idealist philosophers, they tend to think that human action and the world and change in the world is driven by ideas. You know, it's driven by people having a breakthrough, having a realization, having a desire, wanting justice, whatever it is, wanting domination. And because they have the ideas, they go ahead and do things. On the Marxist model, on the Althusserian model, that is exactly backwards. We are not ultimately really driven by particular ideas and by our so-called values. Rather, we are driven by domination, by the need to live, by the fact that we can't eat unless we get a job, therefore driven by the need to get a job, then driven by the need to keep the job. This is the bedrock. And what happens afterwards is that then we are given ideas which justify the circumstances in which we find ourselves and which tend to make that circumstance appear natural, inescapable, desirable, and normal, which is probably just natural again. Here would be a way that I would define ideology. You know, ideology is a system of interlacing ideas, which are the dominant ideas, which cause something which is contingent, namely our reality, which could be different, changes all the time. There really are revolutions. The technical structure is changing all the time. There really are crises. Things are not nearly as like stable and static as we are led to believe. Ideology is a set of ideas that make us believe that that which is contingent, and therefore could be otherwise, is all that is possible, and therefore could not be otherwise. Ideology naturalizes a contingent structure which is really not to our benefit. Okay, so what's included in ideology? Everything that comes through the media. The whole world of art. The world of philosophy and theory. In Marx and Althusser, they would like to exclude science from this. By the time we get to the generation after Althusser, like people like Michel Foucault, they'll ditch this idea that like the kind of knowledge we're looking at here is science either. It's ideology too. It's all ideology. So the dominant ideas, and especially the kinds of ideas that we've been looking at in this class, ideas about freedom, free trade, individualism, nationalism, and so on, these are a part of ideology. And the thesis is, again, the same, that the ideas that become and that remain dominant in a particular society are going to be exactly the ones that facilitate the continued functioning of the structure that is already in place. So in a way, these ideas reflect our reality, but more, they reflect it in an inverted way. They occlude things. They hide things. When we believe that we are a free country and then we go and take orders all day, our irrational belief in freedom can actually prevent us from grappling with the fact that we are taking orders. There is an objective reality, nevertheless, but the ideological reality prevents us from having a direct relationship with our own situation. Ideology is useful that way. And so this is also to say that ideology has a reinforcing role. It programs individuals in such a fashion that they are good in the given system they're a part of. Okay, so this is the basic Marxist theory of ideology. Now, let's move on to this next question, or pair of questions, which is, okay, how in detail does a ruling class, and if you want to understand the ruling class, at least where we are historically in this class, go to C. Wright Mills, the power elite, you know, the owners, the highly placed individuals who circulate back and forth between boards and high military and high government, and then back to corporate positions. How does such a class, how do the Koch brothers, how do they stay in charge? And there's a Marxist answer to this, which is best understood if you think about what a revolution is. You know, if a revolution takes place, historically, I mean, I think this is actually different today. We think about revolution differently. I want to think about revolution differently. But historically, take like the Russian Revolution, for example. What happened when the Bolsheviks took power? What did it mean to take power? It meant to take over the police, the prisons, the administrative apparatus, bureaucratic apparatus, and the army. That's the state apparatus. The state apparatus has many parts, many institutions, but they're unified. You know, there's a chain of command. The president is at the top of some of them. The attorney general is at the top of another one. It's a unified hierarchical system, which basically is, on Marxist theory, a repressive apparatus. You know, what are these things for? The judicial system is for putting people into jail or fining them. The prison system is for holding people who are problematic from the perspective of the order of the whole system. The army is for killing people. The police is for tackling people. All of these institutions are for controlling bodies. It is a repressive apparatus. That's its nature. It's for one, the state is an apparatus that one class uses to control another class. This is the Marxist theory. And what Althusser wants to add to this is that that's indispensable. You know, like, it could no longer be the case that the Koch brothers and Bill Gates and the board of directors and massive dominant shareholders for GE and Boeing and Lockheed and all these major corporations, if they did not have an effective ability to determine how the judicial system was going to be used, when and where the army was going to be deployed, who the police are going to target, because the police come after regular people on the street, right? The police don't go tackle corporate raiders who may have stolen $500 million. If you steal $2,000, you better watch out. They're going to kick your ass. But if you steal $500 million, you're really in a sector where the police don't have much to say about it, right? Now, of course, there is, you know, there's the FBI and whatnot. But the point is that the ruling class has a number of means by which to determine the activities of the state apparatus. They control the state. And think about, like, intellectual property. You know, like, all the property laws that are put in place, they're put there not because of some like deep reality. There's no deep reality that says like the MP3s that I have on my hard drive technically belong to, I don't know, I'm trying to think like what's a good, you know, Def Jam Records. There's no like natural truth about that because an MP3 is just a little digital thing, right? I can multiply those things on my computer ad infinitum, no, without like Def Jam losing anything. So it's not a natural fact that like intellectual property exists, but intellectual property is necessary in order to guarantee the continued supremacy of a certain owning class. So you get the laws that they want. You get the imprisonment schemes that they want. I mean, how many 1%ers are in prison? How many black folks are in prison, right? They want to control a certain portion of the population, but not themselves. So a ruling class has to control the state apparatus. If a revolutionary group were to get hold of the army, if it were to actually overcome the police forces and then like have access to all their guns and all their armored cars, it wouldn't be, you know, a month before corporate control was ended. They have to control the state apparatus. But this is Althusser's contribution here, which, and really he's just echoing this guy, Antonio Gramsci. That's not enough. That's enough for short-term control. But if you want long-term control, you got to have more control than that. Now, there's another question, and what that means is you have to control, you have to have hegemony is the Gramscian term. Hegemony within the ideological state apparatuses. And there's another question, which I mentioned before, which is, okay, how do you continually reproduce a population which has, on the one hand, skills which match the division of labor necessary for this whole system to keep operating the way it's operating, especially given that that division of labor is changing on a regular basis? How do you do that? And how do you, on the other hand, keep a population that is willing to work in whatever jobs they tell you you got to work in? So how do you make a skilled labor force, and how do you make a submissive labor force? And the ideological state apparatuses are the answer to that too. So, okay, what are examples of ideological state apparatuses? Churches, schools, the family, political parties, trade unions, the media apparatus, the cultural apparatus. Basically, any institution or, yeah, I guess institution is probably the right word, regular meeting place, which has regular membership, which has regular rituals, and which percolates a sort of culture with dominant ideas, dominant ways of talking. Any of those things is an ideological state apparatus. They're all over the place. And while the state apparatus is unified, it's like subsumed into one hierarchy, the ideological state apparatuses are, at least on first glance, plural. There's many of them. Where the state apparatus is nominally in the public sector, the ideological state apparatuses are nominally in the private sector. And what Gramsci and then Althusser are saying is that domination happens there too. Control over the society happens within institutions that are not nominally about governance. And the primary way in which they operate is by producing certain habitual rituals of submission, and then sometimes skill sets, and then dominant ideas, like the receipt of dominant ideas. Where do we get the ideas that we get, and especially the ideas that we have as Americans? We get them through ideological state apparatuses. Now, this leads to a couple of things. One, this means that power extends beyond the state. It means that domination happens in just about every portion of your day, but it also means that domination can be contested and governance can be contested in just about every portion of your day. So like there's room for resistance to happen in the internal culture, even of a place as ideologically pushy as, say, like the inside of a police department. You know, a police department externally is a part of the state apparatus, but internally, It's an ideological state apparatus, meaning it has its own culture. It's a place where people become certain types of people, where they come to have certain identities and certain dominant ideas. So those are ideological state apparatuses. Let's see. I guess I'm 45 minutes in, so I'm going to try and go pretty quickly here. Also, I have to go pee, but I can't I can't do that because my little recorder here will it won't let me pause. Okay, so let me just add one more thing here. You can think about, you know, okay, maybe here's where to start. When Althusser looks at the history of ideological state apparatuses, and he's looking particularly in Europe and even more particularly in France, when he looks at that, he says, okay, historically there has been, one particular ideological state apparatus that has been dominant, and that is the church. And he says, as a result, in the course of the Middle Ages, the primary political and revolutionary movements had to grapple with the church and with the ideology of the church. And this is how you get, you know, separation of church and state, for example, coming towards the American Revolution. But as time moves along, moving up to 1968, looking at, say, the past 100, 200 years in France, but I think this would work elsewhere too, he says the school starts to take over for the church. It becomes, and maybe first it was really the church family dyad that had the greatest control over producing personalities, identities, dominant ideas. Okay, hold on one second. Sorry about that. I guess that was a minute of silence, but I am back. My recorder will not allow me to pause, but I certainly did have to make a bathroom break. Anyway, Althusser, among other things, is trying to understand why in 1968 in France, the school was the epicenter of rebellion. Why? Because the school was at that point the dominant institution for the inscription of certain values. And think even more, I mean, this is really important for us because we're in school, right? What is it that happens in school? On the one hand, there are certain skills that are taught. There's reading and writing, which y'all barely learn these days. No offense. 18 years of reading papers and stuff. That's not the skill that is really being developed, but perhaps that's because in industry, reading and writing are not particularly necessary, or rather, they are necessary, but only for the managerial class. So for people who are never going to be managers, who are just going to be rank and file, maybe it's okay to keep them illiterate. But certain skills certainly are learned, and you're learning certain skills, mathematical skills and programming skills and building skills and engineering skills, the kinds of things that are necessary in order for the work to get done as it is getting done right now. But on the other hand, there's something else, and there's something more nefarious, and that is that, okay, you can know all about engineering and bridges and so on, but if you are not willing to build the bridge that they tell you to build, under the direction of the person they tell you is directing you, you're not a very helpful worker to them. So in addition to being skilled, you also need to be submissive. You also need to be the sort of person who is ready to take orders. That's what a good worker is, right? Or that's a portion of what a good worker is. Now, there are also a small portion of the general population who are going to be taught how to manipulate other people. This is human relations. We have happy terms for these things. And those are the people, according to Althusser, who are taught how to manipulate the dominant ideology, to tell people what it means to be a good worker, to tell people what it means to be a good American, etc. But basically, what the school is producing is skilled and submissive labor. And I think that's really important. I think that is still the case. I think, like, whatever other functions education could perform, producing like a critical citizenry, this kind of stuff that I actually care about, those things are being phased out. And they're being phased out, especially as we kill off liberal arts and humanities departments, which are the only places where you get to actually look at history and try to think about how things like power work. You know, they don't want you to think about how power works. They just want you to be worked on by power. Okay, anyway, so in the Middle Ages, in European history, the dominant ideological state apparatus was the church. Coming into the last century or two, the dominant apparatus was the school. Both of these were working together with the family, and the family is an ideological state apparatus. There are certain identities and roles and rituals that are performed in that circumstance, and there are identities which are given to children. Here you are, you're a girl. Girls like pink. Girls don't throw baseballs well. And of course, there are exceptions to these things, but the exception just sort of highlights the rule that we do teach certain roles. And we also inscribe certain ideas into our children. For the most part, I bet we inscribe submissive attitudes into our children because we want them to listen to us. Families are, in a lot of ways, authoritarian. Anyway, to move towards conclusion here, I tend to think that since 1968, another ideological state apparatus, which actually encompasses territorially massive portions of the globe, has become dominant. And that ISA, I would say, is media. We are now subsumed within media in ways that Althusser even, I mean, it's not that long ago, 50 years ago, could not imagine. Maybe now it is the media and the schools, or the media and the family, or just plain the media, that is our primary source for rituals, for the development of certain behavioral routines, for learning dominant values, for becoming who we supposedly are in terms of our belief structure. That comes through the media. And this is the reason that I put we're going to talk about this more with the board next time around. The ways and what, you know, what does it do to us? What does it do to passions and habits and attitudes and thought when we are plugged into screens all the time? We're going to talk more about that. But for now, I included Chomsky just so that you can recognize that the idea that the media is an ideological state apparatus, or the idea that ideology is selected by the ruling class, still operates and can be thought about in an objective and fairly analytical fashion, even in a society that lacks formal censorship. So it's easy to look at, you know, North Korea, or to a lesser extent Russia, and say, hey, look, in those places there is government censorship of ideology. And so what's happening when media is distributed to those populations, it could well be called brainwashing. But then people look at the United States and they'll say, well, or the Western world, so-called Western world in general, and they'll say, look, that doesn't exist in these cases, at least not for the most part. And therefore, we have instead the free flow of information. What Noam Chomsky is trying to show is like, no, that's not true at all. It's just that the controls that are in place are a little bit more difficult to discern, but they're there. And so he offers this, what he calls it a propaganda model. And he says that propaganda or ideology, media content, is selected, is in truth selected, Through a process. First of all, you have to look at the provision of raw materials to mass media, and then he gives us a list of five filters, which basically determine the content of the media that is going to be mass distributed. And his point is that once we get to the actually distributed media content, we are dealing with a very select set of ideas and truths which match, in a lot of ways, that Marxist model that I just laid out. The ideas are the ideas of the ruling class, is the way that Marx puts it. Or the dominant ideas are the ideas of their rule, the things that everybody needs to believe in order for them to be very comfortably still in control. Okay, so first thing that, like, you know, Chomsky, for example, would have you recognize is we're dealing with mass media here, right? Think about how much content is generated by the biggest content producers at this point. Now, the manufacturer of news media, for example, which is just one variety of media, the manufacturer of media in general, this is it's a real industrial production process, right? It in the same way that, you know, in order to manufacture aluminum, you got to start off with some ores. You don't start with nothing. In order to manufacture say, like, you know, BBC NewsHour, you got to have a whole bunch of pre-existent footage, right? Where does all the footage come from? Where do the raw materials come from? This is actually an important question because given that mass media production is so large scale, the provision of raw materials for that production must also be large scale. And that means that there are only a few sources which can dependably be integrated into the supply chain. There's got to be some sources of raw material, raw news, which are capable of offering that stuff on a super large scale. So what are those sources? Well, especially and primarily the government. So there's a tight connection, and I think this is a fact, between the dominant news providers and, say, the press room and the press secretary at the White House, the press room and the press secretary at the Pentagon. And there's something doubly useful from a news production perspective here, which is that there is already a perceived authenticity and perceived authority to things that are coming out of the White House or the Pentagon. Who else can provide material on this scale? Corporations can. So we have these so-called experts who are really already the people who are dominating us, and they provide materials which are then going to be assembled. And then what Chomsky says is that this material is channeled through a set of filters, and it may be that people working within this industry don't even think about it. You know, like a selection process can happen just on the basis of habitual activity without people recognizing that they're narrowing radically and homogenizing the flow of media material that is received. Okay, so filter number one, profit orientation of major media firms. Okay, so that narrows things down, right? Like they want to provide the material that we would say that people want to see, right? That they know that people are going to watch. So there's going to be, this is easy stuff. You know, there's going to be a preference for shocking things and sexy things and violent things. Two, the dependence of media content producers on advertising. Advertising is still, this was like 1983 or something like that Chomsky and Herman wrote this. It's still the case that content producers rely primarily upon advertising dollars for their income. What does that mean? That means they can't piss off their advertisers. So the people who are actually paying them cannot be offended. Number three, there's a reliance on government and business experts, you know, people from think tanks. So there's the need, as I said previously, for large-scale raw material provision. But there is also this need for, like, the accreditation of certain perspectives. So there's a dependence upon so-called experts, which means people who represent the government, people who represent corporations, people who have places within think tanks. And we started to look at the generation of think tanks, like the American Enterprise Institute, when we read Cruz for the first time a couple of weeks ago. Think tanks are not just neutral organizations. They are pretty much the opposite. They are partisan organizations, which try to make partisan positions look necessary, normal, objective. Fourth, flack. That there is a knowledge on the part of, say, like news broadcasters, that if they broadcast certain sets of things, they're going to get crossfire, specifically from certain think tanks and other entities. And then lastly, there are these sort of dominant ideologies. Chomsky talks about, actually, no, it was 1988 was this text, I think. Chomsky, I think of that because it was immediately before the fall of the Soviet Union. He says, like, look, there's this dominant idea about anti-communism that is just unreflectively accepted by all major news sources. Nowadays, that's probably still in place, and I think it's manipulated in certain ways in order to like muster anger against Russia, for example. I think they draw on a whole bunch of old, sedimented Cold War propaganda. But nowadays, it's anti-terrorism. That term, the moment that term shows up, nobody questions it. We all know we got to be against terrorism. Terrorism's real bad. So there are these multiple filters. There's also the fact, in previous times that I've taught this text, I included a text from this guy named Tusu. I think his name's Brandon Tusu. And he would add to this picture that actually the providers, if you go back to the providers of raw material, there aren't that many for the news. There's like AP, APTN, Reuters TV. There's not many like actual providers of raw stories. And distribution worldwide is carried out by not that many corporations too. CNN, BBC, Fox, Sky, Star. There's not that many other ones. So the point of all this is to start thinking. You want to understand how we get the ideas that we get, how we are crafted as so-called Americans with so-called American values, then start thinking about these different ideological state apparatuses, which I've encouraged thinking about all the way through this course, and start recognizing that the media production and distribution system is the rising star in this world. It is the ISA that is growing fastest, both territorially and temporally. It takes over our spaces and our times in a way that pretty much nothing else does. Now, lastly, if you check out the last diagram, the one that talks about how the ideology of the current dominant class dominates regional ideologies. It's not super important here, but I just want you to recognize that we're talking about the existence of different institutional realities, churches, families, schools, businesses, the inside of any institution where people regularly are together and they perform certain habituated rituals. They will also develop basic identities, you know, types of person, manager, not manager, creative, not creative. These are like division of labor separations, right? And they will percolate and they will traffic in certain dominant ideas, certain things that are taken for granted. But this is different in, like, say, a church than it is in, like, a school, than it is, say, like inside, you know, a political party. And these are called regional ideologies, right? You take part in like the Democratic Party. Say you decide that you're a Democrat and you're going to go door to door. Well, the more you're around that party, the more, I mean, like, that's pretty much just about barraging you with ideology, right? They're going to tell you over and over and over, what's the message? Like, what do we care about? Who are we versus who is them? And the same thing is true on the Republican side. You know, neither of these like activists going door to door is immune to a large scale force bearing upon them and telling them like what's of value and why the Democrats or why the Republicans are the ones that
that are good. The Republican Party and the Democratic Party are different, right? They're supposed to be opposed. They're supposed to be the left and the right. I don't believe either of them's left, to tell you the truth. And to tell you a deeper truth, I don't actually think that in the background they're really distinct parties, because I think they are wings operating for the same ruling class. Anyway, the point for the moment, though, is that though there are these different regional ideologies, so the Jehovah's Witnesses really think different things than the Scientologists, even though there are different ideological state apparatuses and therefore different regional ideologies which are inscribed into different people, nevertheless, there is a tendency for each one of those ISAs to be integrated into the overall culture. How does this happen? Well, it happens because there are certain dominant ideas which get integrated into, whether you're a Jehovah's Witness or a Republican Party member or part of the police department or like some kind of, you know, teacher in the LAUSD. There are going to be certain ideas which are shared by everybody. And why are they shared? Is it because it's true? Because no, it's because they express the conditions which have to be sustained for the ruling class to stay the ruling class. Okay, what are the ones today? Say like the idea that technology is advancement. Technological development is progress, period. That kind of idea, you can find it in the Democrats, you can find it in the Republicans, you can find it in the police department, you can find it in the LAUSD. It's all over the place, which does not mean it's true, of course. I mean, 100 years ago, we should have recognized this. When science gave us tanks and then chemical weapons, at that point, and this was like a major crisis in the history of the culture of the global north, I suppose, it started to become apparent that, like, oh, so scientific and technological development doesn't necessarily make things better. It could make them worse. Think about, like, you know, global warming or nuclear stockpiles or toxic dumping. You know, technological advancement does not necessarily mean progress, not really, but we are all told that. And so all of these different ideological state apparatuses get synchronized with one another insofar as they take part in the dominant ideology. What's another one? The now dominant idea of entrepreneurship. Like, a whole bunch of you are telling me in your text that real freedom is being your own boss. Well, I'm not super impressed, because, like, I've been told that over and over and over. And in a way, I'm supposedly my own boss, but I will tell you I am not free. And in fact, the more people become subcontractors instead of being full-time, you know, full regular employees with benefits, the less free they actually are, the less they can do, the more they have to worry. So it's not just true that, like, everybody should be an entrepreneur or that entrepreneurship is, like, the best possible thing. And yet everybody says it everywhere. Doesn't matter whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, whether you're a cop or a teacher. That idea is percolating through the whole society. And then there's some like old standbys in the background. Nationalism, moralism, this whole, like, you know, the humanities crap from ancient Greece through the history of Rome, the whole, like the stuff that we saw in Emerson, you know, that list of, like, the great old white men. There are these resources. There are these ideological resources which exist in the history of the culture, and they exist in the libraries, and they exist in the schools, and they are drawn upon and woven into the dominant ideology. So we have regional ideologies, and then we have a dominant ideology, and this is how ideological state apparatuses are knit together and in the end contribute in a statistical sum to the continued domination of one class or another.